In November of 2013, the governor appointed an advisory council on autism with specific membership, and that was by executive order. So the recent legislation made a few minor changes to the executive order, but codified the executive order into statute.
How does this group differ from that which was appointed in 2005?
Well, I think this council is broader, and one of the things about autism spectrum disorder is that it's a relatively unique subset of relatively vulnerable Kentuckians. So individuals with autism spectrum disorder have often fallen through the cracks in our system because it's considered both a developmental and intellectual disorder, as well as potentially a behavioral health condition. Often it's been between those two worlds, and it also is very much, at least during the youth portion of the condition, it interfaces with the education system. So one of the challenges for families is they might go to their pediatrician and get a diagnosis. They might get seen by a pediatrician initially, but then seen by a child psychiatrist. They might be told that the services are primarily to be provided within the educational system. They might require speech and language services. They might require physical therapy. Often they have potential to have seizures or other neurologic conditions. So the purpose of this council was to better integrate and develop a council through which multiple agencies within state government, and if you look at the legislations, it lists the membership, but it includes the Department of Behavioral Health and Developmental Intellectual Disabilities, but also includes Medicaid. It includes representations from a pediatrician, representation from a consumer. And so the idea was to create a specific council that would help integrate all of the different parts of the elephant that are part of the delivery system so that we can better coordinate care. We have several councils in state government. We have a council on developmental intellectual disability. We have the State Interagency Council on Children, but each of them don't necessarily primarily see autism as a focus of coordination.
I understand that this group is much broader than that group, but it seems to me that they were tasked with the same streamlining of services to ASD people.
I wasn't directly involved with that initial council. My understanding is it was associated with the Developmental and Disabilities Council, and was more narrow, didn't include the other agencies. Also, it's administratively housed in the Commission for Children with Special Health Care Needs, which is within the Cabinet for Health and Family Services, and they have a long history of caring for children with chronic medical conditions and a real history of being direct service providers and directly assisting parents and families. So they have clinics throughout the state. They develop subspecialty medical services. And so this was an attempt, I think, to move it more to the clinical realm. And honestly, came about as a result of advocacy that families were saying that the system is too fragmented. It's too difficult for them to figure out where does treatment exist, where's the best place to get evaluated. So I think this moves it more to a clinical medical home as opposed to being associated with the Developmental Disabilities Council.
Thank you. That clarifies it for me. The report issued in 2006 references the 2000 census, and at that time there were about 24,000 individuals in Kentucky who would be helped. Is the number about the same now?
Well, that's a little bit of a challenge in terms of there's some controversy within the field in terms of the incidence. The number of individuals diagnosed has been increasing, and whether or not that's a result of better diagnostic criteria, better awareness, more people seeking treatment, or whether that's more in relation to an actual increase in incidence, it's controversial and under debate. most of us feel like the actual incidence is probably not significantly increased, but we're doing a better job at diagnosing it. And as you mentioned, the new terminology within the DSM-5 also changes some of the criteria for the diagnosis, which affects incidence, and it is considered a spectrum disorder, so it depends, again, how far up the spectrum. So, for example, when most people think of an autistic child, they think of somebody who's nonverbal, who has little to no social interaction, makes no eye contact, you know, maybe in essence sort of in their own world, doesn't respond to affection. That's kind of the classic autistic child. But we now recognize that it's a spectrum disorder, and there are those that are less affected and might have considerable speech, might have considerable ability to interact, but they do have deficits in what we call social reciprocity. So they have particular deficits around interpersonal relatedness. They don't pick up on social cues appropriately. They struggle to understand nonverbal communication. And so in the past, we would have called that Asperger's disorder. Our new diagnostic criteria kind of eliminates that, and it's all considered autistic spectrum disorders. The short answer is, with the changing criteria and increasing awareness, there are probably, some people say that as many as, you know, 1 in 100 individuals would be affected with autism or autism spectrum disorder.
I note that one of the charges of the, it seems to me even the primary charge for this group, is to promote early diagnosis and intervention. How early?
Autism is a condition that's very often becomes apparent in early childhood. The individuals may have a period of normal development in the first year of life, but typically between a year to 2 years, they begin to show some of the deficits associated with it. So they might lose some of their developmental milestones. They may be delayed in acquisition and development of speech. There are new tools we're developing that include screening instruments that families can participate in with their primary care doctors around identifying some of the early symptoms. And so it's often important to participate in this kind of developmental screening so that we can pick up on early signs. And the literature is supporting that the earlier the interventions, the better the ultimate outcome. So we do believe that the acquisition of speech is a hallmark of ultimate adult function. So that's part of what the council is charged with doing, is improving screening and early intervention and diagnoses, and allowing these families to be able to get connected with resources even within the first few years of life.
Does that mean that primary care physicians are armed with resources that they can give to families facing this upon diagnosis? A Kentucky family can be handed, or will be able to be handed, this is what you do next, or is there a referral system?
There is a system in place, and our Department of Public Health operates First Steps, which is an early intervention program that's been designed to assist when in primary care settings there's a known developmental delay. So if there's a speech delay or a delay in motor milestones or potentially a delay in social development, the first place most families are referred to is called First Steps. And that is, a broad program for assisting in developmental delays. There's a subset of those children that would be likely to meet criteria for autism or autism spectrum disorder. And that's where we have struggled some in terms of having access to the kind of comprehensive assessment that is required to make this diagnosis. It's a big, heavy diagnosis that has lots of ramifications. And so I think historically there's been some hesitancy out there. And I'm a pediatrician as well as a child psychiatrist. And sometimes there's this tendency to say, well, they'll outgrow it, or everything will be, let's just wait a little while and see if they catch up on their milestones. And I guess what I'm saying is that we do think it's important that pediatricians are given the most evidence-based tools for screening, and there are several of those out there. Ages and Stages is a screen that pediatricians and primary care docs can use. And then if there are some notable delays in that screening, that they're referred on for more comprehensive evaluation. And that's something that the council is looking into. Some of those resources have been sort of centered in Lexington and Louisville. The Weisskopf Center at the University of Louisville, unfortunately, has often a 3 to 6 month wait. And so the council is concerned about that 3 to 6 months, because that can be a significant amount of time when you're trying to implement early interventions. So I think if you look in the charge, you'll see access to evaluation and screening is something that the council intends to look into.
I realize that the next question involves an area of response that is way too broad, but there is state funding support for families in certain cases, do I understand, or is it Medicaid support for families with individuals in ASD?
Well, I mean, it is a complicated question because there's a variety of entities that might be responsible. So if an individual has private insurance and they're diagnosed, you know, the first thing that they would do is access their private insurance for the evaluation and assessment. And there's been several pieces of legislation passed historically that requires third-party payers, such as private insurance companies, to cover autism, to provide a certain level of services, even including respite services for families. And there's been some limitations in the past on that benefit. It does fall under Mental Health and Substance Abuse Parity Act, and so it is very important that we enforce those and require those. Now, it is true that very often that Medicaid is the insurance or payer source, and the Medicaid program does have a comprehensive benefit for autism services within it. And then there are even some specialized Medicaid programs for this population. There's something that's called a Medicaid waiver program called the Michelle P. Waiver. And that's something that the state has devoted and has eligibility criteria and has used state and federal matching dollars to create specialized services, so that if you talk to families, some may be served by the Michelle P. Waiver, which is basically a funding source that brings to bear intensive kinds of services like in-home supports, speech and language services, behavioral service supports, and the things that families need in order to care for these individuals.
Dr. Brenzel, you've been most informative. I thank you.
All right. Thank you.